Philosopher, noun, substantive. Philosophus, Latin. Philosophe, French. A man deep in knowledge, either moral or natural. Or a woman, of course. Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and this week on The Philosopher's Zone, we celebrate the man who gave us that definition, Samuel Johnson, born 300 years ago this month. Samuel Johnson was a lexicographer. The definition we began with was from his Dictionary of the English Language, published in 1755. He was a poet, an essayist, a heroically good man, and a tortured depressive. But was he also a philosopher? This week we look at Johnson and at the ancient Stoics. But we're going to get there via what he had to say about a friend of his, a medical practitioner called Robert Levitt. And who was he? To tell us, here's Dr. John Wiltshire, reader in English at La Trobe University.
Well, if you were a doctor in late 18th century London, you would most likely be a member of the Royal College of Physicians. And if you were a member of the Royal College of Physicians, your minimum fee would be a guinea. But if you were, say, a tradesman, you would never be able to afford such a sum as that. And so if you were ill, if you had an abscess or you wanted a tooth pulled, you would call upon one of the small army of unlicensed medical practitioners in the city. And Robert Levitt was one of these. He lived in a famous household, in a strange and famous household, in an alleyway called Bolt Court, just behind Fleet Street in the city. And when he died in 1782... a poem, a famous poem, was written about him a few weeks after his death by a doctor, Dr. Samuel Johnson.
Well, as you said, when Levitt died, his passing was commemorated by his friend Samuel Johnson in a poem, and that's why I'm talking about him today, because I think it's a very philosophical poem. It's called On the Death of Mr., we note, On the Death of Mr. Robert Levitt, a practiser in physic. Condemned to hope's delusive mine, as on we toil from day to day, by sudden blasts or slow decline, our social comforts drop away. Well tried through many a varying year, see Levitt to the grave descend, officious, innocent, sincere, of every friendless name the friend. Yet still he fills affection's eye, obscurely wise and coarsely kind, nor lettered arrogance deny thy praise to merit unrefined. When fainting nature called for aid, and hovering death prepared the blow, his vigorous remedy displayed the power of art without the show. In misery's darkest caverns known, his useful care was ever nigh, where hopeless anguish poured his groan, and lonely want retired to die. No summons mocked by chill delay, no petty gain disdained by pride, the modest want of every day, the toil of every day supplied. His virtues walked their narrow round, nor made a pause, nor left a void, and sure the eternal master found the single talent well employed. The busy day, the peaceful night, unfelt, uncounted, glided by. His frame was firm, his powers were bright, though now his 80th year was nigh. Then, with no fiery throbbing pain, no cold gradations of decay, death broke at once the vital chain, and freed his soul the nearest way. Now, John, I think I first read that poem about 20 years ago, and I wasn't enormously struck by it. I am enormously struck and moved by it now, and I think one of the reasons is that I'm 20 years older. yes. I think it is an older person's poem, isn't it?
Oh, yes, I certainly agree with that. As on we toil from day to day by sudden blasts or slow decline, our social comforts drop away. That seems to me the reflection of an older person, to whom Levitt was a friend, who was Johnson's daily companion. They had breakfast together every morning, apparently.
Now, as I've said, the reason for having the poem in this programme is that I think it's a very philosophical poem, and the prevailing philosophy is what has been described as Christian Stoicism. So what is Christian Stoicism?
Johnson was very well read in the Roman Stoic philosophers.
This would be people like Cicero and Seneca.
Seneca particularly. Mm. And he uses the same, all through his work, he tends to use the same kinds of metaphors as they use, talking about how you can shield yourself against the arrows of pain that are sent to you by the various armies of circumstance. But he almost always, when he's thinking about the Stoic philosophers, the Romans, and Epictetus was another one, he says, whatever the Stoics claimed, you cannot arm yourself against the miseries of life simply by disregarding them. You must have something else. And I think it's the something else that this poem is interested in, and in a way that this poem makes good, makes manifest.
Johnson presumably thinks of himself as living under the guise of a wise and good God. Is that the something else?
I'm not sure that he was ever sure. I mean, I think he thought himself, as I think he says once to Boswell, that you and I are now living under the eye of omnipotence. But the eye of omnipotence for Johnson is not necessarily all-forgiving. I think that Johnson tended to be fearful of whether he had transgressed. But he also felt, I think, very strongly that there was no way in which you could make yourself invulnerable to suffering. What you could do is just plod on through life. Really.
Well, yes. I mean, it's a bit like Samuel Beckett, isn't it?
Yes.
I can't go on. I'll go on.
It's very interesting, I think, that Beckett was a big fan of Samuel Johnson. I mean, he made a pilgrimage to Lichfield, where Johnson was born, and collected Johnson's works and wrote a play about him, in fact. A play, actually, about Levitt.
That's very interesting.
It's called Human Wishes.
Mm. Since this is a poem, it's not a formal philosophical treatise, we should perhaps look at the way in which it achieves its effects. Mm. Now, it's in iambics, which means that every other syllable is stressed, so
yes.
Condemned to hope's delusive mine, didam, 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 and it's in short lines. It's not in the iambic pentameter we know from Shakespeare. It's in an iambic tetrameter, I think. It's four beats in a line.
Which is the beat, just incidentally, of a poem, such a famous poem as Gray's Elegy.
Yes, Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard.
Yeah.
And one of the ways in which it achieves its effect seems to me that the beats come very, very often and very, very heavily.
Yes.
So we do feel the sense of time plodding on.
Well, especially, you know, lines like his virtues walked their narrow round, nor made a pause, nor left a void. The busy day, the peaceful night, unfelt, uncounted, glided by. His frame was firm. You can almost feel this steady, rather determined beat that's echoing something about Levitt's own nature, perhaps.
Let's just look at some of the words in the poem. We gather from the poem that Levitt was possibly a bit of a rough diamond. We're told he was coarsely kind.
He's coarsely kind.
Yeah. We're also told he's officious, innocent, sincere. Now, those are three qualities which we would not readily put together today. What does that mean?
Well, officious certainly means something different from what it means today. Officious means doing good offices or doing good works. And I'm not quite sure that innocent is any different. It means guiltless, in the sense. And sincere, I think it means devoted. I think the interesting line there is, or the phrase is, of every friendless name, the friend, where friendless name means people without important social connections. So there's a kind of play in the poem between that meaning of friendless and the meaning of friend, which is to be, in the modern sense, the friend of someone.
Yes, because, of course, in the 18th century, a friend didn't necessarily mean a bosom buddy. No. I mean, we have the phrase still, it's a bit obsolescent, but we have the phrase a friend at court, which really means a connection.
That's right, Johnson is saying that this man had the kind of warmth that we associate with a modern friend for people who without connections.
One of my reasons for being interested in this is that I think that Samuel Johnson, to this day, his reputation doesn't do him justice. He's remembered as a character, he's remembered as the subject of a famous biography, but in fact he seems to me both a heroically good man. He was a very troubled, an emotionally troubled man who surmounted his emotional troubles and who wrote very, very feelingly and philosophically. Does Christian Stoicism turn up elsewhere in his work?
Yes. Well, in Rasselas, there's a chapter.
We should say that Rasselas was a very short novel which he wrote in about 9 days after the death of his mother.
Yes, and the story goes that it was to pay the expenses of his mother's funeral, because one thing about Johnson that is important, and one thing that's in the background of this poem, is that Johnson had known at least 30 or 40 years of dire poverty and lived from hand to mouth as Levitt did. But he, as you say, he wrote the short novel Rasselas, which is a kind of philosophical examination of the problem of finding happiness in the world. And in one chapter, the prince, Rasselas, is overcome with a lecturer who tells us that we should lay aside our prejudices and arm ourselves against the shafts of malice and misfortune by invulnerable patience. Rasselas is really thrilled by this. But when he goes and sees the man to become an acolyte, he finds that he's in darkness, and he says, "Sir, you are come at a time when all human friendship is useless. What I suffer cannot be remedied. What I have lost cannot be supplied. My daughter, my only daughter, from whose tenderness I expected all the comforts of my age, died last night of a fever. I am now a lonely being, disunited from society." And Rasselas, who's very young and rather callow, says, "Have you forgot the precepts which you so powerfully enforced? Has wisdom no strength to arm the heart against calamity?" The philosopher has no answer to that, and the book is saying, really, there is no way in which you can arm yourself by invulnerable patience. I suppose the implication is that there must be faith of some kind in a benign master of the world who will make suffering meaningful.
John Wilshire, reader in English at La Trobe University, and that conversation came from the Philosopher's Zone archive, which you can reach via our website, abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. The show is The Philosopher's Zone. Samuel Johnson and the Ancient Stoics are the subject, and the network is ABC Radio National. Johnson's dictionary, by the way, defines a network as anything reticulated or decussated at equal distances with interfaces between the intersections. But let's have a closer look at those Stoics with the help of Dirk Baltzly, Associate Professor in the School of Philosophy at Monash University. Now, there are a number of ancient philosophical schools whose names have entered the language. The Cynics, the Sophists, the Epicureans. But of these, I think only one has anything like its original meaning, and that's Stoicism. This is more or less what we would expect it to be, isn't it?
To some extent, certainly. The Stoics think that you should cultivate a life in which you don't undergo emotions or passions. And so the sort of associations that we have with Stoic calm and resilience are certainly there. But what they mean by emotions and the kind of life that they think is the ideal is perhaps a little richer than the English word Stoic.
Well, we'll come on to that richer view of life in a minute, but to begin with, where does the term and where does the philosophy come from?
The founder of the Stoic school is Zeno of Citium, and he's born somewhere around 344, so he's about 20 years old at the time that Aristotle dies. He washes up in Athens after a shipwreck, and at least according to our ancient biographers, is consoling himself by reading a Socratic dialogue in a bookstore. He's very impressed with this and asks the bookseller, "Where can I find men such as this?" And the cynic Crates is passing by at the time, and the bookseller says, "Follow that man." Now, these biographies from antiquity have to be taken with a grain of salt, and I think they're often sort of constructed to be the kind of life or introduction to philosophy that the person should have, given the philosophical views that they hold.
And why is it called Stoicism?
Because when Zeno went out on his own and started having a school of philosophy congregate around him, they met at the Stoa Poikile, a public building in the Agora. And so the Stoics are literally the porch guys.
Apart from Zeno, who are the notable names in Stoic thought?
Cleanthes is the second head. Chrysippus, perhaps the most important, is the third head of the old Stoa. And then our evidence for them gets a bit thin until we run into Roman Stoics like Epictetus, Seneca, and Marcus Aurelius.
Now, as to what they believed, didn't they, that philosophy should in fact be a way of life?
And this is pretty much common to all of the Hellenistic schools. The Stoics are very, very big on definitions, and they define philosophy as the practice or exercise, the ascesis in the craft of what is beneficial to you. So it's something that you work on all the time, not merely a sort of body of knowledge that you master. There's also the sort of internalization of that knowledge. All of the Hellenistic schools sort of give you a portrait of what the Stoic sage or the Epicurean sage would look like. This is a sort of ideal character type, a kind of ideal response to life.
I suppose the big figure in ethics in their day was Aristotle. As you say, Zeno came slightly after Aristotle. How did their ethical thought relate to his?
Like Aristotle, the Stoics are eudaimonists. That is to say, they think that you proceed to elaborate a moral philosophy by talking about the final goal of living, the point of it. And like Aristotle, they identify that final goal with happiness or well-being, eudaimonia. But unlike Aristotle, they think that having the moral virtues like courage and justice, self-control, these are the only things that unconditionally benefit a person, even if one's efforts to sort of make the world a more just place are systematically stymied. Nonetheless, the action proceeds from the right kind of character and, as they say, is perfect and complete just in that.
Now, for them, as we've said, the goal of life is a flourishing, or if you, we could say happiness, but perhaps flourishing is better. What does that amount to? Does that amount to one's circumstances, one's physical circumstances, or is it an entirely internal state unrelated to one's actual physical circumstances?
It's entirely an internal state. The formula for describing what well-being is living in accordance with nature. And that actually takes a little bit of unpacking. They mean, in the first instance, conditionally or with reservation, pursuing those things that accord with our nature. It's more rational for me to seek a place to live rather than to live in the street. In a sort of second sense, they think that living in accordance with nature is living in accordance with your expectations about what a sort of rational and provident world order brings about. So that, for example, when I discover that I've been diagnosed with leukemia, what I should say to myself is, this is an inevitable part of the unfolding of the will of Zeus. And far from regretting it or being upset by it or thinking that my happiness is endangered by it, I should positively will it, for it will only make me dead. It won't make me cowardly or lead me to lose self-control or moral integrity.
This leads us naturally to their view of the emotions, or perhaps we should say the passions. How did they feel about these?
They have an entirely cognitivist account of the passions. They think that every undesirable emotion is a false judgment of a sort of double sort. So suppose I have my diagnosis with a terminal illness and I feel fear. The Stoics think that that very state of feeling fear is a conjunction of two judgments. First, the judgment that something genuinely bad is going to happen to me. And second, the judgment that endorses a certain reaction to that. A kind of psychic shrinking away is the thing to be done in response to that. And it's that latter judgment that accounts for the sort of lived qualitative character of fear. But they think that with sufficient mental discipline, you can learn to correct those judgments. For after all, I'm going to die, but that's not something I have to fear. It's not going to make me cowardly. It's not going to jeopardize my moral integrity. It's rational to disprefer it, but it's literally false to think that it's bad. And correspondingly, the second claim that it's right to be psychically contracted at this prospect is equally false.
Fear was one of two primary passions for them. The other was appetite, wasn't it?
Yes. They think that excessive desire for things that are in themselves not goods, though they may be objects of rational preference, it's another kind of cognitive mistake. So lust, excessive sexual desire, is to invest an external object with a degree of value that's actually sort of rationally inappropriate to it.
Faced with the claims of these passions, they believed that we should be apathetic. What did they mean by apathetic?
The word pathē means that which one undergoes, what happens to you. And so when the Stoics say that you should cultivate apathy, they don't mean that you should cease to care about things. They mean that you should never be sort of passive in relation to circumstances in the world. The Stoic sage is the person to whom nothing just happens.
Stoicism had a long life after the classical era. How did it fare in the age of Christianity?
Christianity is great at assimilating various aspects of Greek philosophy. There are certain aspects of Stoicism that are going to resist assimilation. Greco-Roman attitudes toward Christian humility would be pretty negative. And you can see this sort of around the different attitudes to the sort of twin martyrdoms that you might think about here, Socrates and Jesus. The Stoics are going to look at the trial of Socrates and his execution and say of Meletus and Anytus and his accusers, those silly, powerless men, they thought they could hurt Socrates when in point of view all they could do was kill him. They're in fact quite powerless in relation to him. And that sort of attitude of empowerment in relation to suffering, I take it, is diametrically opposed to the sort of central narrative of the cross in Christianity.
Nonetheless, there were people who seemed to have found something appropriate in Stoicism, and one of the subjects of this week's program was Samuel Johnson in the 18th century, and he, of course, is a man who does have a lot to put up with and is in constant conflict with his own passions, one of which is indeed fear.
Yeah, I suspect that the primary medium for transmission of Stoicism through the 16th century will be Justus Lipsius. He's trying to construct a neo-Stoicism or a Christian Stoicism, and he's drawing principally on sources like Seneca, Marcus Aurelius. And I think it's characteristic of the Roman Stoics that you get less theory and sort of more practice there. They're interested much more in how it is that you would sort of internalize what they take to be the truth of Stoicism. And those sort of psychological techniques for trying to internalize these views, I think, are much, much more amenable to Christian appropriation.
Dirk Baltzly from Monash University. Incidentally, the music in this week's show was by an English composer born in the same year as Samuel Johnson, Charles Avison. The show is produced by the grimly stoical Kyla Slavin, and the sound engineer is the buoyantly Aristotelian Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders. Back next week.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.